And welcome once again to another edition of A Plain Answer here at Redeemer Broadcasting. I'm Dan Elmendorf. Joining me in the studio today is Dr. Mitchell Langbert. He is Associate Professor of Brooklyn College. Mitchell, it's an honor to have you with us today.
It's an honor to be here, Dan.
We live in the same town, and once in a while I'll see you around town, and it's always a joy. You are involved with, economics at the college?
Yeah, I teach human resources and management skills, and I get in my research, I get into education and related topics.
You sent me an email the other day about an article, several articles you've been working on, and one was quite fascinating to me. It wasn't terribly surprising, but it's a stark and startling, as you put it, article, and it concerns, this is kind of political today, but you're looking at the ratio of Democrats to Republicans in elite liberal arts colleges. Well, that's an interesting statistic. And I'm going to turn it over to you. Maybe you can share with our audience, what is it that you found?
Unsurprisingly, I found that they're mostly Democrats. The ratio is about 10.7 to 1 overall, but there are big differences across the colleges, which I think is as important to understand as the underlying ratio.
Right. What really caught my eye was in the email that you copied me on was you had a chart in there. And maybe you can describe this chart to our listeners. I know it's hard to see over the air, but they can imagine.
One of the sources of differences is the field of the professors. And what I found is that fields like engineering, chemistry, mathematics, and in the social sciences, economics, and as well physics and the professional fields, which are often staffed by people from the area, like people who teach, say, business or nursing at a top-tier liberal arts college, will often be people they've hired who work in the area, so they tend to be more ordinary-type people. But the other fields are all the rigorous science fields, where there's less room for ideology and hot air.
Right, right.
And in those fields, the ratios are much closer to what you would expect. Pew found in a survey that about 62% of people with graduate school education are Democrats and 38% are Republicans, which is not surprising because you get a lot of indoctrination in school, and people who stay in school are likely to like the kind of ideology they're fed in the schools. But, you know, so you'd expect something in the area of 20%, 30%, 40% Republicans. But you only find that in engineering. Even in chemistry, which is the next lowest field, the ratio jumps to 5 to 1. And from there, it goes way up. And then if you move to what might be respectfully called the hot air fields, like English, anthropology, sociology, the ratios become astronomical. And in the most ideological fields, which are, I call them the interdisciplinary studies fields, but they're things like black studies, gender studies, women's studies, gay studies, all that kind of thing, I couldn't find any Republicans. I kept that limited to the ones who are purely in those kinds of fields. Like a lot of them are joint appointments, like sociology and women's studies. So those I would list as sociology. But of course, in the fields that were jointly appointed, there's almost no Republicans also. So, you know, things like history, you know, history is 17 to 1. And interestingly, among the sciences, what you see is that the environmental sciences and geoscience, which includes geology and geography, are both among the higher. So in contrast to chemistry and physics, the fields with environmental aspects tend to look a lot more like the humanities and social sciences.
Yeah, I feel that those fields are increasingly co-opted into a an agenda rather than really science.
Well, this data seems to support that. I mean, they look a lot more like the social sciences that are overtly ideological. And sadly, religion, which should be a bastion of conservatism, is among the highest, 70 to 1.
Right.
I found.
I noticed that in your chart.
Yeah.
Well, I really resonated with this chart because I had no idea, you know. I was brought up in a family, you know, as a Christian family, but no interest in political type things at all. Totally, it wasn't even on our radar screen. And so, you know, in the public school system, and fortunately, had an interest in technical things. And I feel that God providentially kind of spared me a lot of the nonsense because of the direction that I went and the interests and what became a calling and finally into the technical field and then engineering and had to take very few of these courses that kind of play with your head and pull you in that direction. So you teach students. You probably see a plethora of student types coming through. What about the student today compared to, say, 20 years ago? Any changes that you've observed?
The biggest change has been the effect of technology, the iPhone, which, and social networking, which I think are a two-edged sword, or maybe a multi-edged sword, more of a mace than a sword. It has many sides. And I see increasingly, and I see this in the younger professionals I deal with, like editors and other young professionals I come into contact with in the education field, that they tend to be a lot less focused and a lot more scattered. They tend to lack interpersonal skills. Writing was always a problem. And this goes back quite a while, but it's gotten much worse. I think the texting created a scatterbrained population.
Yeah, it's like we're getting used to constantly being interrupted. And the ability to focus for a long period of time is almost non-existent.
You know, if you remember back in the 60s, Marshall McLuhan said the medium is the message. I think it's become an extreme at this point that the focus is on the medium and the communication method, and people don't even understand what they're saying or hearing.
You, in an offline discussion, you mentioned Walter E. Williams, I believe. And some time ago, we were talking with him on the air, and he was complaining about kids that come to his class and playing with their smartphone and the phone going off. And he identified that as just basically rude to the rest of the class. And he had some guidelines that he put in place and basically punishment. You know, if you come to my class and that cell phone's going off, you're going to lose 5 points or something like that.
Yeah.
And I, you know what? I don't blame him.
No, he's right. He's absolutely right. Yeah. I think also, besides just being rude, and many of them don't know the basics of courtesy.
Right.
They're also, I think, mentally and emotionally unhinged. I don't know the right word, but they're not in balance. I see them in the gym a lot of times. They don't communicate. They've got their headphones on and they don't interact normally.
Yeah.
I see this more and more, and I've talked to quite a few of them, and many of them say, yeah, my generation or a few years younger, it's going to be a disaster when they get out there and have to run companies. And,
oh my.
You know, it's, and that's on top of the American indebtedness problem and the Social Security shortfall
and dear.
Student debt crisis.
You know all about that. We could talk for hours here today.
Yeah.
Today we're talking with Dr. Mitchell Langbert. He's an associate professor at Brooklyn College. And I've been waiting to ask you this. This is totally unrehearsed. I can't wait. And that is, you and I share an interest in what they call Austrian economics. And mine stems from and perhaps yours does as well, just a love for the free market, because it's in keeping with thou shalt not steal and minimum government involvement. Can you explain what is this Austrian system all about in 5 words or less? No, just kidding.
Well, my understanding of it is it's based primarily on voluntarism and the importance of human purpose in understanding how economic decision-making occurs. What my other paper, University Scientism and American Economic Interests, is about is how foundations encouraged scientism. And I think the difference between Austrian economics and scientistic knowledge is that scientism tries to treat human beings as physical objects, that it tries to find general physics laws, and the human condition is not static.
Right.
It's based on purpose. And so I think the concept of self-actualization that Aristotle pronounced is a lot closer to Austrian economics on a certain level. That, in other words, positivist economics or scientistic economics sees people as compliant. They respond to signals, and the state can change its policies, and people will respond in predictable ways. Mm-hmm. Whereas Austrian economics tends to emphasize secondary effects to a much greater degree, and it emphasizes the ability of freedom to maximize human choice, and so allow people to become more self-fulfilled.
Yeah.
I think that's a lot of the attraction of Austrian economics.
That's helpful. Some time ago, I contacted the von Mises Institute, and I said, hey, do you got an economist there that you would recommend, a Christian guy? And they mentioned Sean Rittenour, and that developed into a friendship, and I know he's still associated with von Mises, so it's a very interesting line of study, I think. Let's talk more about the bias that exists at the university level. It seems that university, by its very nature, should look at truth and follow it wherever it leads, and kind of have this broad view and then narrow it down and have your field of study and just keep on taking the data and be very, very open and, you know, honest and understanding. But I don't see that happening today at the university level.
No.
What is going on?
Well, you know, and I think this gets back to the ratio of Democrats to Republicans and religion, because I think religion is a pivotal subject. A lot of people don't know that American colleges were primarily religious institutions until well into the 20th century. They began to change in the 1870s with the founding of Johns Hopkins, which was the first American research institution. But all the other colleges, except for Harvard and a few others that were slowly changing, were still very Christian. And they evolved slowly as they broadened the definition of Christianity in response. I think Darwinism played a big role, the theory of evolution, that they had to respond to that development, and that encouraged secularization. But there was also still an emphasis on Christianity going into well into the 20th century. And this was a bone of contention for the dominant foundations that funded higher education, beginning with really George Peabody. And there's the Peabody Foundation still is around, but his protege was J.P. Morgan, his protege was J.S. Morgan, whose son was J.P. Morgan, who worked for Peabody at early in his life, and then purchased much, you know, fast forward to towards the end of his life, purchased Carnegie Steel, which then Andrew Carnegie used the proceeds to fund the Carnegie Foundation. And the Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Teaching, along with the Rockefeller-funded General Education Board, worked together in the early 20th century to try to make universities more positivist or scientistic. Uh-huh. And a big part of their agenda was to drive Christianity out of the colleges.
That's a major statement right there.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's not hidden. Man. It's well known. I mean, if you read the history of the Carnegie Foundation or the history of the educational development, actually, there's not a lot of integrative work in this area, which is why I wrote the article. But if you look at the history of the development of the social sciences and you look at the history of the foundations, you see that the two things were hand in glove, that they were the same. That the foundations were funding colleges in order to drive Christianity out of the colleges. That wasn't the only purpose, but that was part of it, in order to make them more like research institutions that were supposedly value-free. But inevitably, they became left-wing. They were funded, and the chief alternative to Christianity was left-wing ideology. And so, although they voiced positivism, they hid the positivism in an underlying point of view that was left.
That we see happening so often. I think of an example here where the left will use words and twist them and make them sound good. Here in New York State, we have something called the SAFE Act.
Yeah.
For example. Well, that doesn't help safety. You know, disarming the populace, how's that going to help safety? Or let's say the Affordable Care Act. Well, it's not affordable. And from what I've seen, it's not too caring. But, you know, they put these words together and make them sound really good. We have to be more discerning as the public, it seems.
The left has twisted language since the beginning. And I think one of the worst abuses is the word liberal.
Yes.
Which actually meant freedom, belief in freedom.
Yeah.
And they've turned it into something that meant authoritarianism.
Because in the best sense, when I think of, when I put politics aside, if you have a liberality to your spirit, you're generous. You're giving to others. You're not holding on to everything for yourself. You know, it's at a personal level. You're certainly not stealing, and you're certainly not stealing and redistributing wealth Robin Hood style. But that's in the very classical use of the word liberal. But what it's become today is something far different.
180 degrees different.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's all in the language.
Yeah.
And, you know, of course, then as they tainted the word liberal so that it became unpopular, they started to call themselves progressives.
I noticed that.
Which is also a misuse of language, because their economic theories are really 17th century theories. There's nothing progressive about them.
No, not at all. You're causing me to have some flashbacks here. As I sit here, I'm thinking about, because I did go to the public school system, now and then you'd get a teacher, and I didn't know at the time. I just thought they hated Christianity, which they did, but they're basically like little communists trying to brainwash us.
Yeah, yeah.
And I didn't know anything about this at the time.
Yeah.
And they were more prevalent, I would say, in the social sciences, and it kind of goes along with your article here. And I'm thinking, man, what a mess to do that to kids and to brainwash them. Now, going forward, I don't want to be too negative here. It's very easy to get negative because there's so much that's broken that needs to be fixed. But I'm okay with just thinking about, okay, here's an incremental thing we can do, let's say at the university level, to kind of fix things in the right direction. Any ideas? Oh, and I want to say this too. I happen to know of a couple of schools that don't take federal funding. I happen to come across, I think it was Grove City, Hillsdale, you know, those type of schools. And it seems to me that the higher principle here is, if you take government funding, well, he who pays the piper calls the tune.
Yes.
Yeah.
So. That's absolutely right. I would look for alternatives. Some of the schools that were somewhat more tolerant of Republicans are Kenyon, and I'm a fan of St. John's College in Maryland, which has a great books program, which I highly recommend.
St. John's College?
Yeah. And it has a long history. It goes back to the 18th century. And
I've heard about this great books. I didn't realize it was from them.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, cool. They've been instrumental in that idea.
You know, if I had to change one thing in my life, well, I'd change a number of things, but I would have definitely tried to read some of the classic works and the great books. And now I'm older, and I barely have time to brush my teeth. You know, it's just, you start, folks, if you're younger, read, and read widely, and try to read really good stuff.
Yeah, one of the effects of the scientistic left-dominated university is that they discourage the examination of important classics in Western literature, which really drive our civilization, and encourage instead over-specialization in unimportant, narrow subjects or overtly absurd kinds of studies. Someone showed me an article yesterday that Yale is now finding that the students need safety animals.
Safety animals? It sounds like a little kid in a crib.
Yeah, they don't allow pets, but students who emotionally need...
What do they have, stuffed animals now?
No, they're real, like pets that they have because of emotional...
Well, maybe a hamster or something.
It's become like, not only dumbed down, but emotional retardation down, as
Lord
well. You know, it's pathetic on a certain level. Yeah. And so you have a lack of exposure to the great works of literature, and you have a lack of exposure to history. You don't have rigorous mathematics education. They're not taught grammar. So what I would say is they're doing a terrible job overall, and parents are well advised to send their kids to private schools, Christian schools, homeschooling, and to think about alternative colleges. One college in my sample, Thomas Aquinas, was all Republican, believe it or not.
Oh, wow.
You know, it's a conservative school that was founded in response to a lot of these trends a long time ago. And I think we need more of that. We need more innovation. And part of the problem, of course, is government regulation that impedes founding colleges.
Mm-hmm.
And that needs to be changed. There needs to be more flexibility. And I think alternatives to college should be explored. And it needs to be more of a market in higher education, and that means deregulation and ending a lot of the subsidies.
That's right.
Possibly a voucher system. People know about the voucher system for K-12, but what about a voucher system for higher ed, eliminating the huge subsidies places like Harvard and the elite places get? They get most of the money. Make no mistake.
And I'm quick to say that I'm not in favor of New York State handing out free college. I think if you're going to go to college, you should pay for it yourself, and ideally work your way through, and it'll make you appreciate it more, and you'll be more careful as to what courses you take, because it's not being given to you for free. Hey, we're fast running out of time today. If someone would like to read more of your writing, where could they go?
Well, the piece on homogeneity is online. It's on the National of Association Scholars website. And as well, another piece I had done with Dan Klein and Anthony J. Quain on economics, law, psychology, and history, which found similar things to the recent piece, except they found them in research universities, whereas this piece is liberal arts colleges. That's also for free online and readily available. My piece, University Scientism and American Economic Interests, is in the journal Industry and Higher Education, which is available through Sage, if you can get that from a library, the Sage journals system, you can download it. Or you could email me, and I might be able to find a copy somewhere.
Or contact us here at the station, and we'll put you in touch with Dr. Mitchell B. Langbert. Associate Professor, Brooklyn College. Mitchell, it's a great honor to have you on with us today. And any final suggestion for a young person thinking about going on to university?
First of all, I would look for alternatives, whether that means taking individual courses before you just go for a degree. There's no question that degrees are compensated. If you finish a degree, you Right. tend to earn more, which is unfortunate. But
Yes.
I would also look for alternative kinds of schools. I would focus on the STEM fields. Science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, and right. stay away from the ideological fields, women's studies, gender studies, this studies, that studies. And I would also stay away from the soft subjects. A lot of students go for the easy subjects because yeah. it's an easy A. So they take stuff like anthropology or English, and they're rewarded just for echoing the professor. I would go for the hard subjects. You'll get a better job that way. Yeah. If you major in, say, math or chemistry, there's much better the job market in yeah. fields like computers and petroleum engineering and engineering in general. They're much better job markets in those fields. Mm. So although the grades are lower, your job prospects will be much better when you graduate.
Oh, that's excellent advice. Dr. Mitchell Langbert has been our guest today, Associate Professor, Brooklyn College. And if you want to listen to this broadcast again, it's up on our website as a podcast. Check us out. We're found at RedeemerBroadcasting.org. And for Redeemer Broadcasting, I'm Dan Elmendorf. Please join us again next week at the same time.